Welcome to Double Jeopardy, the law and politics podcast.
Each week we'll be joined by a guest or two to discuss the law, how politicians are improving it or screwing it up, and what it all means for our increasingly battered, unwritten constitution.
We're hoping to be entertaining as well as serious, and we're definitely not going to be an echo chamber. All ideas are welcome here. I'm Ken McDonald, the former Director of Public Prosecutions and a criminal barrister at Matrix Chambers.
And I'm Tim Owen, also a barrister at Matrix Chambers, specialising in crime, public law and human rights law.
Hello there and welcome to the third episode of Double Jeopardy, in which Tim and I have a conversation with Professor Kathleen Stock. We recorded this conversation before judgment was given in the case of Maya Forstatter. As many of you will know, Maya was fired by her employer, the Center for Global Development, an American NGO, for expressing gender-critical views. In effect, she'd put out a number of tweets stating her belief that sex is real, that biological sex is real and immutable. Well, Maya took her case to an employment tribunal, which found against her, saying that her views, her gender-critical views, were, quote, not worthy of respect in a democratic society. Not surprisingly, Maya appealed this to the Employment Appeal Tribunal, which disagreed with the employment judge and said that the gender-critical views which Maya had expressed were protected beliefs under the Equality Act, and sent the case back to the Employment Tribunal, which duly found that the Center for Global Development had discriminated against Maya in firing her on the grounds of her beliefs. Now, I mention all this as background because, as many of you will know, Kathleen Stock was also forced out of her job for expressing gender-critical views, in her case, forced out by bullying and harassment and lack of support from her colleagues and the university. And if you think there's a pattern here, that's because there probably is. Anyway, we hope that you enjoy the conversation. Tim and I are absolutely delighted that Kathleen Stock, Professor Kathleen Stock, has agreed to join us to talk about her work, her experiences, and her reflections on where we are in what I suppose I might very loosely call, although she may tell me this is the wrong way to describe it, the gender debates. Kathleen is a distinguished philosopher. She was a professor at the University of Sussex, and her areas of interest included aesthetics. She was vice president of the British Society of Aesthetics from 2019 to 2020. She left Sussex in December of last year, I think it was December, under circumstances which we're all too painfully aware of and which we will be discussing, I think, during the course of this podcast. But Kathleen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm pleased to be here.
And I wonder whether we could start, whether I could start just by asking you a little bit about your background so that we can situate your career before, if you like, the storm burst over the last, I guess, 2 or 3 years. You were a well-respected professional academic philosopher.
I think I was reasonably well-respected.
Well, I think you were very well-respected, and not, so far as I can tell, and so far as I can tell, looking for trouble anywhere, not looking to stir up controversy.
No, not really. I only wanted to stir up controversy in a tiny, tiny little pool of academics and go for a drink afterwards sort of thing. So, in other words, just a standard philosophical kind of attitude towards abstract problems.
Well, that's what academics do, isn't it? They fight over things that seem to other people to be quite small, but actually can be quite important intellectually.
Yes. Oh, I'm not sure now, looking back, how important intellectually any of it was, but at the time I felt it was. So I was just a ordinary, I don't know, I was on the kind of train track of academia. I did a PhD, got a job, then, you know, a couple of temporary jobs, and then I got a job at Sussex in 2003, I think, and then I just did my thing, kept my head down.
So you were brought up, I think, in Scotland, and was your father an academic?
Yes. So I was born and brought up in a small fishing town called Montrose, near Aberdeen-ish, and my dad was at Aberdeen University as a philosopher. He had sort of converted late in life and gone off to Birkbeck when he was in his late 30s to do a philosophy degree, and did it in the evenings, and then got a first and then got a job. So he had moved to Aberdeen for his first job, met my mum, who was also an academic at the time in physiology department, and then had me and my sister. So we grew up there. They're both English, which is why I sound the way I do.
Actually, I was interested, Kathleen, because you did a very, I think, wonderful podcast recording with Andrew Sullivan on his Dishcast podcast, and you described yourself, I think, as an outsider growing up in Scotland, in Montrose. You said, you know, I was 6 foot, I had glasses, I had an English accent, I was keen to get a boyfriend. You then described how you had to sort of adapt your accent so that you fitted in, and then you went to Oxford, and you described it as a posh, fee-paying, mouthy bunch of confident people. And you're describing yourself as a sort of outsider in both those things. And I was just wondering whether that's relevant to your becoming interested in philosophy, and then obviously more recent events.
Well, yes. Well, I don't know about philosophy. I sort of feel like I fell into that. I was quite good at it. Sort of took it to see at Oxford to see what it'd be like, because you can't really do. I wanted to do French. I did French, but I also had the opportunity to do a bit of philosophy. But definitely, I didn't feel particularly at home growing up in Scotland. I wasn't made to feel at home, to be honest. And then when I got to Oxford, I didn't feel particularly at home either. I mean, I've come from a comprehensive. I was in a college with a very small number of women anyway, and most of the people there were straight from, you know, Eton and Harrow and Winchester and all those places. And I've never really, you know, felt those were my people, although I can get on with, I think, most people. So, yeah, I do think it's sort of a bit existential, probably.
I mean, I went to Oxford in the early 70s from a state school, and it could be quite an alienating place. I mean intellectually quite intimidating, obviously, if you come from a school which hasn't sent people there in great numbers, but also quite socially intimidating.
I mean, at Exeter, so I was at Exeter College, and I don't know if they still do this, but they had, you know, every Sunday they'd have a kind of JCR meeting, junior common room meeting, and they'd have this sort of speaker who was voted in called the Malarian professor. And within about a week of arriving, you'd troop along and sit there while this second or third year just ripped the piss out of all the first years that had just arrived, reported on who was sleeping with who, you know, humiliated several fresher women who had only just arrived, laughing at their look or the way they talked. You know, I mean, it was a properly savage environment to suddenly arrive in. When you're young and you just think, oh, I just want to go and have a nice time, you don't really realise that everybody's watching in a college, everybody's watching everything you do. And that's quite an impressive thing.
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, looking back, it's extraordinary that those sorts of rituals were tolerated for so long. I mean, I'm sure that, well, I spent 9 years recently as head of a college in Oxford. It certainly didn't happen in ours, and I hope it didn't happen in others. But you're right about the goldfish bowl. There's not much that's private in Oxford College, but you obviously did very well at your studies, and you got a scholarship, I think, to do a PhD, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And that's unusual, Kathleen. I mean, getting a scholarship to do a humanities PhD is very unusual. It's very competitive.
It wasn't that unusual. It wasn't that unusual back then. I mean, I'd done unexpectedly well at Oxford. I hadn't really done any work until my final year. In fact, my tutors despaired of me. In fact, they told me so. But I did manage to pull it off in the end. And then I got some money to do a PhD from Leeds. But yeah, maybe. I don't know. Didn't feel very competitive at the time. I think Leeds has got a lot better since then in terms of its PhD programme. So it's probably much more competitive now. But I just wanted something to do. So.
And then you did you followed the normal academic path of doing a couple of sort of contract jobs. I think you were UEA in Norwich before getting a tenured position in 2003 at Sussex. So then you had your full-time job, tenure, security, and you could focus on what it was in academic philosophy that interested you, and you took quite an interest, I think, in aesthetics.
Yes, so my PhD was on imagination and fiction, and that's really the line that I pursued all the way through after that. So just big philosophical questions about the nature of the imagination, situating it within the philosophy of mind. So what's the relationship between imagining, belief, desire, other mental states, and then connected questions about fiction and what, you know, because obviously I think we engage our imaginations when we read fiction, and then you can ask lots of big questions about the nature of fiction, fictional characters and all that. So that's the kind of place that I was most focused on, though I did occasionally do other things like stuff on feminism.
One of the things that you've been criticized for by those who disagree with what you're saying is having no expertise in the area that you're addressing, the gender area. It strikes me that actually you have a very significant level of expertise in something which is quite important in this area, which is the imagination. I mean, it sort of goes back to Aristotle's poetics, doesn't it? What happens when you immerse yourself in a fiction, the catharsis, the empathy. You talk about immersion, and we'll get onto that later, but that training, it seems to me, is clearly relevant to some of the views that you've formed since in this area.
I think, I always did think so, and I used to sort of bristle slightly, well, not slightly, quite a lot, when it was accused of me that I didn't, you know, I was a new entrant into this area. By the way, also, I mean, that in itself is preposterous, because in philosophy, most philosophers I know move from area to area depending on where they want to go next. They just read up, they write something, they publish it, and nobody ever minds. But of course, you'll find when you get into this debate that I'm in that suddenly the bar is a lot higher.
Also, what on earth would be the training, so to speak, or the expertise to express a view about this area? I mean, it's just preposterous, isn't it?
They just mean you haven't sort of ingested the relevant biblical texts and you're not prepared to recite them back is what they mean. But yes, it is about fiction. And of course, the thing is, I couldn't say that at the beginning. I knew I had to build my case, because if you can't say anything in this area without being shouted at. But if I went straight in and said, this is all based on a fiction, that would have been considered absolutely heretical. So I felt I couldn't say, yes, my expertise is highly relevant, but I knew it was.
Kathleen, you said somewhere in a vivid quote which chimed with me, you said, I didn't become a professional philosopher to go to church. And I enjoyed that because having had a fairly religious upbringing myself and then abandoned all religious belief by about the age of 16, I've always felt that I didn't become a professional lawyer to go to church either. And I was curious to ask about the point at which you realised that the area of academic work that you are involved in, you had to go to church in order to fit in and be accepted.
Well, I knew already before I even started that that's the way it would be, because I'd seen what had happened to another philosopher called Rebecca Tuvel, who published this incredibly restrained, in fact, rather sort of friendly to the ideas I want to criticize article. But because she made a parallel between transgenderism and transracialism, this phenomenon of people thinking, white people thinking they're black or acting as if they are, the mob just came after her and her own editorial board. You know, they'd been published in a feminist journal, and the editorial board, as I recall, put out a statement decrying the article, so that they themselves were responsible for. So it was a terrible scandal, and I watched all that happen, and I also saw how major figures in my profession, like very influential people, talked about the sorts of views that I had. And it was with nothing but contempt and a kind of moral disapproval that was absolutely suffocating. So I knew that I would be saying heretical things.
I mean, the idea was precisely that, wasn't it? That these were illegitimate things and couldn't be said. And one of the things that Tim and I were very keen to explore was this notion that's grown up in universities of all places, that some views, some interpretations are simply not legitimate, that they're not to be expressed, and if they are expressed, they're not to be tolerated, and the individual who expresses them will suffer damage as a result of that expression. I mean, I remember when I was in Oxford over the last 9 years, thinking around 2014 or 2015 that something strange was happening. I mean, I was aware of what was happening in the Ivy League, but it seemed to me that the nature of the belief systems that the students were entering into were increasingly closed and intolerant from that point on. Did you recognise the same sort of thing in Sussex?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Sussex is a left wing, or in some sense of left, you know, I would say not a very good one, but it's largely left wing. It styles itself very progressively, and a lot of the academics there style themselves very progressively. And it has been obvious for a while that there is a kind of accepted set of kind of basic tenets about ethics and politics, and particularly in the area of social justice, that if you disagree with them, you are strongly disapproved of, but mocked. You know, I mean, it's not rational. Nobody comes up to you and says, "I'd like to argue with you about that." It's like, "Oh God, that bloke."
Or, but did you know that? No, did you know that when you joined the university?
No.
Were you aware? Because I'm aware that Sussex had had that. I went to the LSE in the 70s, and you know, LSE and Sussex, which was then a new university, relatively new place, already had that reputation as a very liberal, progressive place. In other words, you know, Roger Scruton probably wouldn't have got an academic post at Sussex University.
Well, they barely got one at UCL or whatever. But yeah, yes, I wasn't aware of anything when I joined at Sussex. I mean, I was just completely naive, delighted to get the job. And actually my department, the philosophy department, was always slightly anomalous, I felt, because it was full of people that were quite open-minded and fairly Catholic politically as well. And we talked about political philosophy and political ideas in an open-minded way. So I felt insulated, and I had nothing to do with the wider university for years. So I just was able to not really notice.
How shocking, Kathleen. Philosophers with open minds. That's...
I know. they are still out there. They really are still out there.
Actually, let me ask you both that, because I, you know, I'm the odd one out here in the sense that I've never been involved in academia. I've been a barrister since leaving university, basically. I mean, you've obviously had different roles in the academic world, and Kathleen, I'm not sure. Obviously, you left Sussex last year. You're no longer, are you, employed by university? But I mean, would you encourage anyone to join a university now and become an academic on the basis that they could, you know, operate freely and with all the traditions that you would think are necessary to be a free thinking academic?
Well, it depends on the subject area, I think. I mean, if you're a medic, as actually my sister is, you know, very doing really amazing, worthwhile work, and I don't see any impediment there. The university system's obviously the best place for you, I should think. So if you've got a kind of discrete, methodologically disciplined project to get on with, that's not really going to be subject to political dimensions, obviously, then I don't see why not. But
I really meant you're in your era, in humanities, I suppose.
I'm afraid I'm having a bit of a crisis of faith about the humanities at the moment, so I'm not sure I can say anything too positive.
And Ken, would you encourage me to become the warden of an Oxford college?
Well, my observation would be that I think the situation with the faculty in Oxford is a bit different, although of course Selina Todd, a very remarkable historian at one of the colleges in Oxford, had issues with this, because she's I think holds gender critical views, and there was a certain amount of targeting of her. But my observation about the Oxford faculty, certainly in my college, would be that it retains a degree of openness. I think some of the younger academics are certainly worried about whether, if they hold views that might in some circles be considered heretical, it would damage their careers. I mean, I remember in my final year talking to a junior research fellow at lunch, and he kept lowering his voice, and I asked him why he was lowering his voice, and he said to me, because I'm saying things that I don't really want other people to hear. And what we were talking about was concepts of social justice as they are emanating from the United States at the moment, and he was taking a view which wouldn't necessarily be the consensus view in the Department of Politics and International Relations, and he was a bit concerned about that. So I think that's something that I don't think you'd have found 10 years ago. You wouldn't have found it 15 years ago, and I found that troubling. I also think there is, well, we're going to talk about immersion later,
Kathleen, but I think there's an amount of sort of fictionalizing that's going on, and people purporting to believe things that they don't really believe, because not to believe them is regarded as being outside the parameters of what is acceptable. So I think it's probably the situation is probably variable in different universities, but I think there is a real risk. Let me just so tell a brief story. That Timothy Gartnash organized a lecture some years ago in Oxford, and the then dean of the Yale Law School gave the lecture, and I was to give the public response to the lecture. And he was arguing that our notions of free speech are mistaken, and that we could properly see speech as a tool of oppression. And that's as equally valid an argument as seeing it as a tool of liberation. And that was the first time I'd really heard that being articulated, and I felt he was just being provocative. But I think that's now a widely held belief across universities in the United States, and I think it's a widely held belief amongst many students, certainly amongst many students in Oxford. I think it's less widely held amongst the faculty, but the very fact that intelligent young people believe that free speech is more properly to be seen as a tool for the maintenance of oppression seems to me to be deeply troubling. And Timothy and I drafted a free speech policy for the University of Oxford, which basically said, you know, come to university, prepare to be shocked, and get on with it. How long that free speech policy will last is another matter. But I think that there are all sorts of issues around free speech, Kathleen, in universities. Do you agree?
Oh, 100%, yes. And it's so ironic to me that, you know, these views are most virulently held in places like Oxford, you know, where these people are going to sail off, most of them, into the highest echelons of the elite, and they don't really apply it to their own speech ever when it comes down to it. It's only other people's. I mean, it's really just a tool of power. It's a way to wield power over others. It's a competitive world. They're very anxious. And I mean, I'm sure there are other things going on, so that's a bit reductive, but it's definitely, that's a dimension to it that doesn't really get addressed, that we're just handing people a set of weapons to shut up other people who might be competitors or who might be making them feel uncomfortable.
I think that's a very useful way of looking at it. And in fact, you were obviously a victim of that. Can we just talk? I want to talk a bit. I don't want to sort of...
Before we go on to that, sorry, Ken, but can I just, before we move on to that, there's one question I want to address to both of you, again, as the sort of the non-academic here. Because as I've been thinking about this, I've been trying to work out whether I'm looking back, we are looking back with rose-tinted spectacles to an era where things were fundamentally different. And, you know, as I said, I was at the LSE in the 1970s. I was there, you know, in 1979, the year Margaret Thatcher was elected. And the student population was unbelievably, I look back now, intolerant, shouting people down, trying to deplatform Tories. And student opposition and deplatforming is not a new thing. You know, 1974, the NUS came out with their no platforming policy, anti-Nazis, and so on. Is the difference that the academic staff now, who you might expect more of, you know, it's one thing when you're 18, 19, 20 to be intolerant, confident of your views, unwilling to believe that you could be wrong. But the incredible thing about your experience, Kathleen, that I've read about, is the extent to which your fellow academic colleagues were putting up with this bullshit of intolerance and deplatforming.
I mean, I think probably in 1979, there were a bunch of self-interested narcissist academics back then too. However, they have the internet now. and that's the big difference. The internet allows, and particularly attracts, the sort of more narcissistic, stupider academics, to be honest, onto the stage where they can command big audiences and they can have power. So there's that aspect that the internet has changed everything. It allows people to organize, it allows people to get a false sense of the group. You know, many dynamics are going on there we don't fully understand. We didn't have the internet, but I also wanted to make the point about connection to mental health discourse, which I don't think was there in 1979. So now the people, both academics and students that attack me, constantly connect what I say to a threat to mental health and want to protect students in terms of mental health, way beyond, you know, the parameters of what mental health used to be understood. So just give you an example, when the stuff was kicking off at Sussex and there were, you know, posters everywhere about me and men with flares and balaclavas and all the rest of it, there were people at the university putting on extra workshops for trans students in case they were harmed by what was happening to me. Right, so that's the thing you're dealing with, that there's an automatic presumption that they are harmed and I am harmed and speech is harmful.
This is a really disturbing counter reality that someone is being subjected to this kind of physical threats almost. I mean, when you've got men with balaclavas holding flares and chanting your name, that's a threat. I mean, arguably it's an unlawful threat. Arguably it's a criminal threat.
Yeah.
And for the response of the university, rather than offering you all the things it might have offered you to put on extra workshops, is just, I mean, I think this mental health thing has become a trump card, hasn't it? I noticed this very, very strongly in Oxford over the years I was there, that the extent to which it grew and grew and grew and grew. So when I first started, we used to have maybe one or two students a year who would say, look, I'm too anxious to do my exams in the big examination halls. I need a room in college where I can do my exams on my own because I suffer from anxiety. By the time I left, we had so many students making this demand that we'd run out of rooms. I mean, I used to say to people, maybe I was being unfeeling, I used to say to people, look, are you feeling anxious about your exams? Yeah, that's normal. You know, it's normal to feel anxious about your exams. What we've done is we've medicalized across all sorts of areas. We've medicalized problems and issues that are entirely normal and a part of life. And I think you're absolutely right that this has been a major feature of the response to counter arguments in this area, that you are damaging people's mental health and you will drive people to suicide. And that's combined with the bogus use of statistics, which I think you expose very well in your book. I'm going to give you a plug now. Material Girls, Why Reality Matters for Feminism, Kathleen's book, which everyone listening to this podcast should buy and read, debunks the abuse of statistics very well. But this is a problem, isn't it? Medicalization.
I read today that some universities are giving content warnings to students who are applying to study forensic science on the basis that they may have to look at images which are upsetting. Like, what the fuck are you doing applying to do forensic science? Yeah. You're not going to look at some dead body.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the infantilizing. It's so embarrassing. Why do people want to be treated as so weak and pathetic?
But it's like a virus. I don't think they do. I think it's actually just a virus in the minds of administrators and academics themselves. I mean, it's very small numbers asking for these changes, but because they're in such a kind of safetyism mindset, the thing just keeps creeping out. I'm sure you just keep thinking, well, I did it there, so why not here? I gave a trigger warning there, so why not here?
Yeah, my daughter who's an academic got into trouble for not giving a trigger warning before a lecture, and a student complained, and she was called in to see her head of department, and she said, look, the title of this lecture is The Rwandan Genocide: Rape as a Weapon of War. That's the trigger warning.
Yes.
I mean, obviously the lecture contained distressing content, but wasn't that pretty? Anyway, this is a bugbear of mine. I'm quite hostile to the whole idea of trigger warnings. I mean, I'm
sure
there's some extreme cases.
They don't work.
Of course they don't.
They don't work. I mean, there's evidence they don't. There's evidence that they actually make people anxious.
Sorry, perhaps we won't be giving them in the beginning of this podcast.
We're all getting a bit aerated here and talking on top of each other. Kathleen, can we move on to your experience? I mean, obviously we do want to talk about your ideas in this area, because that's what this is all about. Your entirely legitimate and well-argued and closely argued ideas, I might add. Whether people agree with them or not is a matter for them, and I know that's the view that you take. But before we get on to that, can we just talk a bit about your experiences at Sussex? To coin a phrase, you put your head above the parapet and dared to address these issues in a way that wasn't necessarily the conventional wisdom, and essentially all hell broke loose.
Yes, pretty much. I mean, I chose to address it through speaking to the public, and I think that's part of why I got such a big pushback almost immediately. So I wanted to make an intervention during the government's public consultation on gender recognition reform, And, you know, and we're encouraged actually as academics to talk to the public and to make blog posts and
impact.
Exactly. So yeah, I thought, impact. Well, I'm going to have some impact. So I did. Yeah. I just, you know, wrote a couple of pretty amateur looking back blog posts, very hedged, super hedged. I mean, I asked a question even, I didn't answer it. I was like, why aren't we talking about this? And is it possible that we need to examine these questions? But I didn't actually say what I thought. And then that was like dropping a stone. And then there were various sort of ripples outwards, firstly within philosophy, where immediately I got quite a lot of pushback. Then people started to notice in Brighton. I did an interview with the Argus, which went, you know, they took a very sensationalist headline. And then I got a lot of pushback from the public, and the university started to get massive complaints about me, and there started to be protests. There was one on campus in 2018. So, you know, and then I started to be asked to do things, and then when I did them, there'd be more protests, or there'd be petitions or open letters, and I was deplatformed a couple of times. So it just all, you know, it just kept going. And then, of course, there's a sort of codependent relationship where the more bad attention you get, the more attention you get. So therefore, the more you're asked to do. And so it just kept...
And was that before you'd published Material Girls?
Oh, yes. I only published Material Girls last year. So I've been doing it for about 4 years now, I think.
So what was it you said, Kathleen? What was it? I'm curious. What was it that you'd said in relation to the Gender Recognition Act that had caused this extraordinary pushback?
Well, I said, so the headline of the infamous Brighton Argus interview that caused me all the grief was trans women are male and many of them retain male genitalia, which is a fact as far as I'm concerned. I mean, there's evidence that surgery rates are low. There's evidence that they're male because they wouldn't be trans women if they weren't male. But, you know, people don't want to hear or didn't that fact. And that's the thing about speech. It always reverts to speech. In saying that, even if it's true, some people don't think it's true, but even if it's true, you're harming people by saying it, because it's harmful to point out the sex of somebody who's got a different gender identification. So that's the assumption, that I was harming people by mentioning the word male, even though it's real.
So let's get to it then. The issue of self ID, self-identification, which the government has been toying with. In other words, you can, in essence, as I understand it, change your sex by declaring a different gender identity. What's your beef with that? Why shouldn't people be allowed to do that?
Well, change your legal sex. You can't change your sex. I mean, we have to keep specifying this because people now think you can change your sex, literally change your sex, and you can't. But, yeah, the idea is, and it's an idea that's been pushed for several years, and I think if Labour were in, they'd probably still do it. So it's on the table, and it's going through in other countries. It's already gone through in some other countries. And the idea is that there should be no barriers, gatekeeping around legal sex change. At the moment there are, and so, you know, you can get a legal sex change, but you have to fulfil certain conditions. There's a medical requirement, the diagnosis of gender dysphoria, which is a mental health condition. All of that gone, you just get to fill in a form, pay a bit of money, and not too much money either. They don't want it to be expensive. And then you get to change your sex. And this will give you, I mean, the relationship between the Equality Act and the Gender Recognition Act is a bit unclear, I think. But they think, the trans activists, Stonewall, etc., think that this should give you access to any, well, actually what they think is anyone who identifies as a woman, any male that identifies as a woman, should have access to any resource or space that a woman has access to already, even if they don't have a gender recognition certificate. But so that's an even more extreme position. But that was my entry point, because there was this consultation. So the underlying idea is gender identity trumps everything else. And so it should be in the Equality Act rather than gender reassignment, and it should be in the Gender Recognition Act. And gender identity is supposed to be this inner psychological state. Well, I don't know even if they think it's psychological, they think it's kind of metaphysical, but, you know, there's an inner state of feeling like a male or a female that does not necessarily connect to your actual body. And that's the thing that should determine whether you're a woman or a man. And that's the thing that should determine where you go in social space. So all of that I disagree with.
One of the problems with the Equality Act, as I understand it, it says it's illegal to discriminate against a person because of gender reassignment. And there's no actual need for a gender recognition certificate to make you eligible for protection. But the explanatory notes are very ambiguous, aren't they? Because they say that the definition is where a person has proposed, started, or completed a process to change his or her sex. And so, I mean, where does that take you?
Yes. So sex is mentioned there. And well, it makes it obviously in conflict with the sex bit of the Equality Act, because sex is also protected. So they carved out these exemptions, single sex spaces, I think originally as conceived by the legislators were supposed to be female only, but because this idea of changing sex has kind of migrated in, it's made people confused as to whether trans women should be in the women's changing rooms or not.
So, Kathleen, can you tell us what's the kernel of your argument against self-identification in the way that you've just described self-identification?
Well, I think it has various socially deleterious effects on particular groups. Women and girls being a big one, because males don't change as a sort of general population. There's no evidence that males change their characteristic behaviours when they start identifying as women. There are patterns of sexual predation that we can predict in the male population, and their main targets are women. And they're so. On that score alone, this is just an invitation for predatory males to enter wherever they want, because who can tell them to stay out? Now the policies say, if you feel like a woman, you can come in. They can say, well, I feel like a woman, you know, tick. So there's nothing, if you've built that into the policy, then there really is, we've just got mixed sex spaces. There's just gonna be no social norm that says, no, I'm sorry, you're a male, you shouldn't be here. And that is that norm was protective of women. So that's one area. Then there's the sport area, which is another big area, women's sport. Then there's the children area, because there's a huge problem of children socially and medically transitioning to their own detriment. So the fundamental problem is that this idea that your inner states can dictate outer reality is an illusion. And any set of policies based on that sort of form is going to have massive practical problems.
Can you say something, Tim, if you don't mind, because I think this is a very good point at which to bring in your notion of immersion, Kathleen, which seems to me to derive from some of the work you've done in aesthetics. And I mentioned Aristotle's Poetics, the idea that when you're observing a play or reading a book or indeed listening to a piece of music, you go into a state in which you begin to believe, you allow yourself to believe that what you're seeing is real. I mean, when you go and watch a film, you're not constantly saying to yourself, well, you may have, it's a bad film. You enjoy it most if you immerse yourself in it and accept the reality of it. And you say that that notion has some significant crossover in this area. Could you explain that? Because I think it's very interesting.
So, yes, I mean, I think the most charitable way to understand, in the philosophical sense of charitable, the most charitable way to understand these mantras like trans women are women, trans men are men, is as a kind of fiction that we're being asked to immerse ourselves in, and that some people do. Some trans people immerse themselves in those fictions, some allies of trans people do. And that means, you know, immersing yourself in a fiction, as you just said, it's a capacity that nearly all of us have. We do it all the time. I think, you know, if you read a novel or watch a soap opera, go to the theatre, or just kind of daydream, you know, and imagine alternative realities, we can think our way into those situations. It can become quite compelling. Sometimes we can feel very emotional and connected, and we can, you know, live in at the extreme end, we can live in a fantasy world.
And we
actually,
love it.
I think the internet
and we love it.
It encourages people to do that. We love it, and it can be incredibly, I love it. I mean, I wrote a book about fiction because I love fiction. And it can be very rewarding. You can learn things about yourself, and you can learn things about alternative realities. You can lose yourself you know, completely. But it has its costs. It certainly has its costs personally if you can't get out of the fantasy. And, you know, there are some things you just cannot name for yourself anymore because they're too painful because you're lost in the fantasy. This is speaking generally. You know, it could be a fantasy of being lost in a video game world. You know, there are more than one way to go wrong here. But it's also very, very harmful if we're institutionally and legally and politically compelled to immerse ourselves in that fiction. And that's my major worry, that at the moment it's getting better, but we are still expected in many sort of cultural spheres to go along with this fiction, and we are socially penalised if we don't. And that's the real problem. I mean, there are, you know, I think that's the thing we need to focus on.
Can I just come in on or follow in on that? Because I think that what you've been describing in immersion is linked in a sense to a view of a cultural sense as opposed to a purely legal sense, obviously. And one of the things that came out of, do you know about the Christie Elan Kane decision in the Supreme Court, where there was a judgment at the end of last year where the applicant was arguing that it was unlawful and in breach of Article 8 of the European Convention on Human Rights to deny her the ability to be identified as an ex on her passport. In other words, the current British policy is that you're either male or female. And so she was saying that's an unlawful approach. And the Supreme Court rejected that, and it's going to go to the European Court of Human Rights. But one of the things that was surprised me when I read the judgment is that there are a huge number of other countries that do allow an indicator other than male, female. So, for example, New Zealand since 2005, Australia since 2011, Nepal since 2015, India since 2014, Pakistan since 2017, and Canada have all recognised the idea of, you know, a third gender identity or a non-gender identity, which sort of surprised me. And I'm thinking certainly in the case of Nepal, India, and Pakistan, that's very much to do with the cultural history of treating certain people, I think they're called Hijran or Khawaja Sara, which translates as eunuchs, as a distinct gender category. And so you're looking there in countries which are surprisingly giving recognition to this additional concept of a different gender. And it's all about whether law follows culture or whether culture is supposed to suddenly immediately dictate that we've all got to accept some concept that hasn't yet been recognised.
I mean, exactly. I mean, a lot of this, the push in our country comes top down. And I don't think it's in sort of a natural part of our culture. It hasn't naturally evolved. It's been pushed. I think as far as the identity document discussion goes, I think we just need to work out what identity documents are for. And I must admit that I'm not entirely settled in my own mind about that. Certainly the way it's presented by, for instance, that claimant and the way it's presented in, for instance, the Yogi Carter principles, which I discuss in the book and which have been very influential across Europe.
Well, curiously, not cited in the Elan Kane decision. I was quite surprised. They didn't cite the Yogi Carter principle.
I think the general idea is that your gender identity is supposed to be so fundamental to you as part of who you are that it's sort of the state, it's part of your human right to have it recognised by the state. And it's a kind of act of recognition constituting you as a subject, as it were. Like, you know, it would be very violating not to have your true nature recognised by the state. I mean, I think that's nonsense because I don't think gender identity has that kind of metaphysical fundamental part of yourself. I think it can change, obviously, and some people don't have one. But it is a separate question about whether that's what identity documents are supposed to do, or are they supposed to, identify facts about you that might be relevant to social organisation? There's lots of undocumented people in the world who really want to be documented, not to be recognised, but just to have access to services. And women need access to services. So I think there's lots of complicated, interesting issues around that one. We're not treating it in a very intelligent way.
I mean, the Supreme Court's answer was to say that the key question is, does this issue, in other words, whether you can put X in your passport, concern an important facet of your existence? And secondly, is there a consensus across the Council of Europe states? To which the answer was no. I mean, we'll see what Strasbourg has to say about it.
Well, there might be soon. There may be soon.
There may be soon.
Kathleen, you talked about this being top down. I think that's very interesting because this is essentially an ideology that's being right, whether it's a right ideology or a wrong ideology, that's being pushed by elites. And I think we recognize its origins in US Ivy League universities. And it's quite American in flavor. It's a sort of combination of American Puritanism. In other words, you will believe this, otherwise you're a heretic and you'll be cast out, which is a kind of, you know, Witches of Salem notion, and a competing and inconsistent American belief that you can be anything. You know, you believe it and yes, it will happen. You can do anything. You can be president. The sort of American dream, total capacity of everyone to be everything. It's a sort of peculiar, destructive combination of the belief, of the notion that if I believe something, it will happen, it will be true. And if you don't believe that belief, you're cast out and you're a witch. And it's sort of transplant. It's sort of started there, and it's, I mean, what I think is not the least of its most interesting features is the rapidity with which it's taken hold. I mean, it's been quite extraordinary.
I agree, and I haven't fully understood it myself, but I think one aspect. So I completely agree with what you just said, particularly the bit about you can be anything. I think really it's almost a kind of steroided version of liberal principles, like freedom is, you know, you need to be free from your own body even. You can modify your body. So it actually connects with prosthetic surgery traditions and all the rest of it you can change yourself in any way you want. But also, I think what's underestimated, genuinely underestimated, including by me and by anyone else I know that's written about it, is the influence of internet culture in the last 10, 15 years for youth. Because we weren't there and we haven't been participating in these massive online movements on Tumblr, these things called fandoms, these actually loads and loads of fiction, fan fiction, which has gradually got more and more towards about trans identities. And there's just generations of children and teenagers, quite often with social problems or autism, on the internet, proliferating these identities. And what's hilarious or tragic is that they've been picked up by elites and pushed as sort of in the direction of policy. So as somebody pointed out to me the other day, we're getting policies coming from governments now that reflect what was happening on Tumblr 2015, like all this stuff about non-binary stuff and asexuality and gray sexuals. I mean, I don't even know if your listeners know what those things mean. Demisexuality. There's all these sort of identities to do with sexuality and gender, which are now being operationalized and which Stonewall is trying to get money to get into our policies. It's just crazy.
Your eight key moments, which I found fascinating, the last one, the, chapter eight, so to speak, is the explosion of identities. And Stonewall, you quote, describes trans as an umbrella term, including transgender, transsexual, genderqueer, gender fluid, non-binary, gender varied, crossdresser, genderless, agender, non-gender, third gender, bigender, trans man, trans woman, trans masculine, trans feminine, new toi. And Facebook offers.
Okay, I think that's enough genders.
But I mean, this is just, where are we? It's just insane.
But the important point to make here surely is that when we cross over from this to start talking about medical intervention, some of these children, and we're talking about very young children in some cases, are incredibly vulnerable. And the ease with which some of this is facilitated seems to be quite alarming. And there's clearly some pushback now. And I know that in America, you know, Britain is commonly known in some circles now as transphobe island, you know, because we're pushing back.
Turf island.
Turf island, yeah. Against these might be badges of honour, of course, who knows. But I do think that the vulnerability of children to some of this can't really be overstated.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's where, you know, your heart just sinks, because it seems quite funny until you remember what's going on out in the culture, how this is all disseminated out to people who don't really understand where it came from and really are treating it as articles of faith and a kind of enacting it on their own children. based on sometimes the barest of cues. I mean, sometimes it's just a child liking something that isn't typical for their sex, and the parent is assuming, well, this must mean that they're trans. And you know, that it's worse in America, I actually think, because it's so unregulated and you can do surgery much younger. But even in our country, there's a, you know, quite a substantial, I think, a substantial number of children whose physicality has been permanently changed by buying into this ideology, and by the adults around them buying into this ideology, including the medics that were supposed to be looking after them. We still have a major push coming through Stonewall to ban what they call conversion therapy for gender identity, which just means talking critically about it and introducing the idea to an adolescent, or, you know, perhaps you're not in the wrong body, perhaps you're gay, or perhaps you're autistic, or perhaps you're you've got a history of trauma. So there's, we still have this terrible, damaging ideology front and center in our elites that is harming adolescents. And at the other end, age 25, you know, when they've come out and their prefrontal cortexes have grown in, a lot of them are detransitioning. They've got irrevocable effects. Some of them lost bodily parts or gained other ones. And they're devastated. They're absolutely, it feels for them like they've emerged from a cult. They lose all their friends because that was, you know, so there's just a series of terrible things happening at the sort of sharp end of all this while the academics sit around posturing. And that's what's disgusting about it.
And Stonewall's approach is that the only appropriate response to a young person or a child questioning their identity is to affirm that questioning.
Yes, I don't see. I mean, I think they've started to hedge from what I've seen. Maybe they're a bit conscious there might be some legal challenges at some point, but they definitely. And I mean, actually, the main charity in charge of this, as it were, is called Mermaids. And Mermaids, that's 100% been their view for years. In fact, Susie Green, the CEO, has gone round all the TV sofas saying that if you don't affirm your child, they're likely to kill themselves. And there's kind of these awful mantras like better a trans child than a dead child. And so parents are terrified.
And they cite some of those apparently bogus statistics about this. The other issue, that's obviously one issue. The other issue is what happens to women's sex-based rights. And I just want to read something from your book, Kathleen, where you quote Marilyn Fry, the second wave feminist. And in this passage, she's referring to woman in the traditional sense. And she says this: being a woman is a major factor in my not having a better job than I do. Being a woman selects me as a likely victim of sexual assault or harassment. It is my being a woman that reduces the power of my anger to a proof of my insanity. If a woman has little or no economic or political power, or achieves little of what she wants to achieve, a major causal factor in this is that she's a woman. For any woman of any race or economic class, being a woman is significantly attached to whatever disadvantages and deprivations she suffers, be they great or small. And you comment, getting rid of this concept of woman would mean that we couldn't describe, explain, predict, or manage these distinctively caused phenomena. Could you expand on that a bit?
Yes. So I think that the sex you're born into makes a difference to your outcome most of the time, or at least for significant numbers of us. I'm sure you can think of counterexamples, but for most of us, it makes a difference. Had we not been in that sex, we wouldn't have had the outcomes socially that we did. And that's partly because for women in particular, reproduction plays a very big role, and reproduction then has knock-on effects for your economic status, for instance, and that's a big thing. So women tend to be paid less, not because actually they're paid less by the hour here, but because they tend to have to take lower paid part-time work to fit around childcare, which means they don't get promoted and so on. So your sex is a determinant of your outcome, at least generally speaking, on average. You know, I'm not making a necessary claim about that. I'm just saying if we statistically we can see that. And we need words to be able to describe the sexes. And we also need words to be able to describe the sexually mature women from the girls, as it were. So we need women and girls, man and boys. And I think just we need those words. And every natural language has had them. But what we are being pushed to do is to eviscerate our language of those words, either to expand the category of women to include males, or get rid of the word woman altogether because some people find it offensive and replace it with things like menstruators or pregnant people and all the things you've seen the Daily Mail get annoyed about. But they are being pushed through some of our institutions, not all of our institutions. I don't suppose, you know, the House of Lords is doing it, but, you know, the NHS is doing it in some places anyway. So if we can't, I mean, so the structural patterns will not disappear when we cease to name them. And it's a very hubristic way of looking at the world to think that we have such a power of language that if we stop naming things that somehow the structures will of oppression will disappear, they will carry on. We just won't be able to do anything about them. And that's such a shame when feminism has made such gains in pointing these structures out and then getting lawmakers and policymakers to do something about it.
It's been an enormous pleasure and extremely stimulating and interesting to talk to you. I must say, for my part, I'm sure Tim agrees, I'm full of admiration for
absolutely.
For your fortitude and your resilience. I mean, whether people agree or disagree with what you're saying, I don't see how listening to you, anyone could A, accuse you of being transphobic, or B, think that it was somehow illegitimate for you to express the views that you're expressing. I think that view, that stance is a direct assault on academic freedom and you know, good luck.
And everyone should buy Material Girls. It's brilliant.
That's so nice of you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Double Jeopardy. If you enjoyed this episode, please listen to the first two, which are available on the website. And we've lined up a number of interesting guests for future broadcasts, so please join us there. Our producer is Billy Lawrence.